What up, meepsters? This is Ryan Rainbro, and if you're hearing this, that means you're about to listen to one of the 99 free episodes of the Meep Meep Podcast, available wherever you cast pods. But keep in mind that there are new and unreleased episodes of the show on patreon.com/meepmeeppod. So you'll want to sign up there to hear future episodes and also other side projects like Choo Choo, the show about soundtracks, and contribute suggestions for future episodes as well. Will I listen to your suggestion? There's only one way to find out. patreon.com/meepmeeppod. Bye! Welcome to Meep Meep, the Roadrunner podcast, where we go through the albums of Roadrunner Records with the artists who made them and the musicians they influenced. Let's roll.
Meep Meep.
The hell was that?
Look out!
And look, here you bitches. Mike's playing a song for us. Sounds really weird. Sounds cool. I wanna dance to the song. Mike's playing a song, and I like the song.
Sit down, man.
Mike, come here and tell us who this is. Hurry up before it starts.
Yo, what up?
Yo, what up?
Baby Fox.
Baby Fox!
What up, meepsters? That's right, it's Baby Fox. And that was Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope, as well as Mikey Clark of the Insane Clown Posse from February of 1999, where they played this song, Dum Dum Baby, by Baby Fox on their hit radio show, The Juggalo Show. And even though that was 99, we are deep in 1998 on the Meep Meep Podcast. Continuing with this episode on 1998's album Dum Dum Baby by the band Baby Fox, a trip-hop classic it is often called, but they prefer the term electric dub blues. And we'll be speaking with one of the juggling trio, Alex Gray, from the band Baby Fox, will tell us all about making this album, making the album before, how they got on Roadrunner, how they got off Roadrunner, and much more.
Here we are, on Meep Meep Show. Call me Violent J, but my real name is Joe. That half of Detroit City already know. Because I like the flow, my cash files grow. I'm on the Meep Meep Show. The Edge 105.1, like the son of a gun. I'm on Meep Meep Show with Shaggy 2 Dope. And there goes the monoxide chop at the wild. Where's Mr. Reed? He's down with me.
Baby Fox comes from London, where the trip-hop genre was essentially created and thrived. Bands like Massive Attack and Portishead all kind of came from there and really made their mark. And even U.S. hits like Everything But the Girl, who had that song Missing that was somewhat of a trip-hop top 40 song. They're from the London area. So they were deep in that. They were much more into the dub music. That we'll find out, that kind of influenced trip-hop. You know, I guess when you're on the precipice, the catalyst of a new genre, you're bringing in all your influences. But Baby Fox is a really interesting band. I mean, nothing on Roadrunner is anything like them before or after. You know, oftentimes we'll talk to and about bands that aren't what we think of when we think of Roadrunner, like the kind of metal bands like a Fear Factory or a Sepultura, but they still somewhat fit into the canon of the label. Baby Fox is completely out of left field, but this album, Dum Dum Baby, I think is incredible. So if you're not familiar with it, definitely after you hear about kind of how it came together, check it out. This was actually their second album that came out on Roadrunner, their first in 95 or 96, A Normal Family, depending on which release you got and what area of the world you were in. So this was after band singer Christine Leach had also helped write a trip-hop, to some degree, hit song for pop artist Madonna. Ever heard of her? She has no last name. Now, did Christine teach her the terrible British accent that she used for a year or two? I don't know. But the song Ray of Light was co-written by Christine. And so coming off of that, we lead into the album Dum Dum Baby, and that's what we are going to be talking about today. So here is Alex Gray.
Just push
the more I push. What's it like to see them fall? Tush, tush, the more I push. What's it like to see them fall?
We were mates, like, way before the band started. We were good friends. We hadn't worked together professionally, although I tell a lie, I did some demos for Phonogram with Christine in a early band, which would have been, wow, maybe like 86 or something like that. That didn't take off, but we kind of stayed friends because we were the same sort of group of friends. In fact, I think Dwight wasn't with Christine then as a romantically, but I had nothing really to do, and I kind of went and did some other stuff, and we were all doing other stuff, and then we actually kind of got together doing stuff after it was kind of me and Dwight really kind of got this club thing going. We started a club night because he lived in this kind of amazing weird sort of trackside house. It was like right next to the railway, big old house that was kind of condemned, semi-condemned, but it had a huge cellar. Like, so the cellar had sort of track level height to, I mean, it was kind of 30 foot height ceilings. Anyway, great place for parties. So we started doing some parties, and then I think we got into the mood of, we were kind of doing stuff together again, and I think it was Dwight that suggested we go and go to this op shop and get some kind of fancy dress clothes one evening. And we're talking now about maybe late 90. And one evening, I mean, we went and got these fancy dress clothes, dressed up, and I think maybe ecstasy was kind of just about coming around then, in our kind of locale at least. I think we dropped some ecstasy and sort of started making some music because I had a studio at home then. And we just did this jam. It must have been October 1990, something like that. And that was the beginning of Baby Fox, essentially, you know. So kind of a long time, at the point I was making, quite a long time before maybe you guys or anyone else, you know, thought we were actually doing stuff as a band, you know. What happened is that we'd put out our first single through, and this would have been spring 91, through a friend of my roommate. He had a little tiny little independent label, but his day job, he worked at Rough Trade. So we put out what effectively was the beginning of this jam session I was telling you about in my bedroom, I actually had a separate studio in our flat, in our apartment. I mean, it was just kind of pretty rough and ready, but, you know, it was a studio. And so he put that out on his label, and then Rough Trade basically stopped being a label, I think, or in terms of distribution. I think he went to go and work with a label called Big Life, which might mean something to you. It was kind of a pretty important small dance label in the early 90s. Anyway. And he was talking to the guy who he was working with at the time, who is now happens to be the president of Ireland, I think, Darkest Beast. But we put this independent record out with this friend of a friend, and it got some great response, actually, on a small level from some important DJs. In fact, including Massive Attack, I remember, who thought it was really cool. Daddy G thought it was really cool. So it got a little bit of traction. And then we put another record out with Big Life. And I think Big Life at the time had Darkest there. And he said to someone, oh, yeah, I'm on a record, because I'd sampled Darkest on the B-side of the original 12-inch. Because I think Dwight had known him. Dwight was making videos at this time. And he'd sent him some stuff, and Darker said, oh, yeah, I've just heard the tracks. It's great. I really want to put a single out, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we put this on the record, and Darker's played this record to someone who happened to be a guy called Simon, who just started this label called Skunk Records. And we put something out with him, another little one-off single, you know. So there's a whole three or four one-off singles with different people. And about 18 months later, Simon gave us a call. Bearing in mind that was just one single. And he got in touch with us and said, listen, I've got funding to do my label properly. And I'd really like to do an album with you. And it's an unlikely source, but I've got funding from this heavy metal label called Roadrunner. So they basically bankrolled Simon to do Skunk Record. Well, was it Skunk? It was Malawi, that's right. In Simon's terms, it was just another iteration of the kind of type of weed that was going around at the time. So hence Skunk, then Malawi. But so he'd got bankrolled by Roadrunner to do Malawi, and we got to do an album like with proper funding. And that is the roundabout way of, so kind of a bit of a, and I don't know how he made that original connection with Roadrunner, but I think I never know how to pronounce it, but the original guy, of course, he was based in Holland, so not far away. There must have been some kind of dance label thing, or maybe Case just thought, I've got to get in on the UK dance kind of thing, because there's so much stuff to be had from such a fertile kind of time, you know. So that's the link. Got there eventually, but
That's very interesting. But I mean, I can see that going from Malawi kind of being almost like an imprint of Roadrunner It seems like you kind of go to being on Roadrunner more proper, because even that album Normal Family gets like kind of reissued as like a Roadrunner version.
Yeah, well, it was okay. So the kind of like the flip side of the coin was that it didn't go well beyond the two albums that Simon put out on Malawi. One was a band, I can't even remember, they were way more kind of straightforward indie, English indie kind of, you might even call it a bit of a sort of shoegazy kind of act. I can't even remember what they called. Bennett. They were called Bennett. So there was only Bennett and Baby Fox on Malawi. And I think pretty much what happened was they didn't like anything else that Simon brought to the table as potentially moving forward. And I think pretty much what happened was that he had his funding pulled, and it's like, oh, no more. I can't develop my label. But of course, we were then in sort of Roadrunner. And if you imagine, it was a slightly odd situation for us, because suddenly we didn't really have our oarsman kind of, you know, in control of the thing. We were like this trip hop act on directly involved with a metal label, you know, and the go between of this sort of cool little dance label with Simon at the helm was gone. That link had gone. So, you know, when it came to doing Dum Dum Baby, it was a very different kind of arrangement on all levels. There was quite a lot of negative associations with it. And probably the most important thing is when we went to do the US tour of our first US tour to promote A Normal Family, Dwight was refused entry. So at Cincinnati Airport, you know, when we arrived for a 3-week tour, he gets sent back. So it was like, you know, I mean, just like the worst possible situation. So we did the tour, but we actually got a life-size cardboard cutout made out of Dwight from one of the videos. And we, because, you know, we were going down to South by Southwest, and then which was originally, well, it still is in Austin. So that was kind of like the second day in. And then we were going to go and do the Miami Dance Conference. And I mean, it was, you know, it was potentially a really good thing for the band. And it, no doubt it would have propelled us onto bigger and better things. But, you know, you can imagine being in Dwight's shoes, like, sent back, suddenly he's on his own, and what should have been the pinnacle necessarily, but the next big stage for the band, he couldn't be part of. it was a screwball situation. So yeah, that's kind of like the background to Dum Dum Baby, and ultimately you could argue the sort of the demise of the band, you know, because it was just like one big bummer. But you know, I have to be sort of philosophical about it, because bearing in mind by that stage the band had kind of been together sort of as a band for 8 years, you know, so maybe we'd kind of run our course on it anyway. So
you know, you kind of mentioned even the catalyst of the origin of the band is you guys going and getting costumes, and you have a Dwight who you're saying is making videos. So do you think that whole kind of multimedia presentation of the band was something that was interesting to either just Roadrunner or your fans in general? It seems like it was more than music. It was kind of a whole, like, almost art project.
Yeah. I mean, we were, I suppose we were really into film, and Dwight's background was classic sort of art school background. He'd been doing kind of performance art and video and stuff, and you know, he went on to his early career as a video maker. He was very successful at it. He was making videos for Radiohead and Blur and all sorts of different people. But yeah, the multimedia thing was his kind of angle. He, you know, he was really into film and sampling soundtracks and bits of stuff. And Christine had this just beautiful soul voice that really kind of glued the sort of music and the production that I was doing, and manipulating some of the music that Dwight was into. Bear in mind, we were all really into dub music as well. That was the unifying kind of thing. In fact, even when we first knew each other, back in this this student house in Kingston that was another one of these kind of semi-condemned houses. It wasn't quite a squat, but it was kind of not far off it. We used to have these things called, and it was in a street called Ashdown Street, and we used to have Ashdown Mashdowns, you know, and basically come back from the pub and you know, spliff up and have a little kind of dance mini blues parties, sort of, you know. So yeah, the music kind of shared core was definitely dub, and the film thing was something that I shared with Dwight, but it was Dwight led on the kind of visuals for sure. But yeah, it was a really kind of fertile mix, and it wasn't that we kind of sat down with a, you know, with a kind of a plan, as is very often, you know, with bands. It's kind of quite a kind of, it's just a fertile sort of joint interest area that produces stuff that's quite instinctive. And sure, we kind of went down some routes that weren't quite gelling, but I think because we weren't under huge pressure to do, it's not like we'd kind of built up this big fan base and there was suddenly a lot of pressure from a record company to get this record out. It was really quite a brew over several months, you know, maybe year, 18 months of actually making the record. So yeah, the influences were quite brilliant actually, and unique.
Well, yeah, you even mentioned you kind of breezed past it, but I want to focus on the fact that you're saying in the, you know, early to mid 90s, you had a home studio and you're like, oh, you know, it was kind of a makeshift thing. But, you know, that's an important thing to point out, that now, of course, everyone has a home studio, right? I take my phone out and I have a home studio, but that would have been a big deal for you to have recording equipment and stuff, you know, kind of in-house. So is that something? I know that you're saying Baby Fox almost happened like accidentally, but were you just always really into production and then making music, or that's just something you kind of fell into?
Yeah, no, you're right on it, Ryan. My father was a professional musician, classical bass player, actually. And so I had this sort of classical grounding, whether I liked it or not. I didn't really enjoy playing the violin, but, you know, that kind of was my experience as a kid. So music was always there. And I always wanted to do music in some shape or form. And I'd been in three or four different bands sort of growing up, and in, you know, kind of dreaming of becoming a pop star kind of stuff, as we all do. And, But I'd always really been into the idea of making sounds in the studio. So I'd always, like, as soon as I could, I kind of saved up my Saturday job money and I got a little kind of Porter studio, and as opposed to being a kind of in a gigging band, as it were, I never really much majorly enjoyed touring. It was kind of being a painter with sound in the studio. So yeah, I'd always done that. And then I kind of, I suppose about that time, somehow I got involved in writing music for adverts. Friend of a friend started some new company that was quite successful quite quickly. So I found myself writing music for ads, and that was pretty good money, as you might imagine, especially then. So yeah, I needed a studio to do that stuff, and I had the wherewithal financially to get gear together. And yeah, we had this spare room in our apartment. So it was quite unusual, actually, to have a kind of home setup, but it just meant that we got quite a lot of the early stuff done. And also when we went on a couple of trips, certainly one sticks in my memory. We went for about a week or two down into the middle of the countryside, in, I think it was on the border with Wales. We were in the middle of nowhere, and we rented this cottage, and we probably produced a third of that first album there as well. We hired a car and put pretty much the whole studio into this car and this little 18th century cottage, and rammed it full of the gear, just had it permanently set up. And we kind of made music every day for a couple of weeks, you know, ad hoc.
So when you would go into, you know, other studios to make these albums, was that exciting for you to have new toys to play with, or did you feel less comfortable than your kind of home setup?
Okay, so the room in this house, that's where it sort of started with Baby Fox. But by the time we were doing that album, I had my own studio, or at least I had a kind of a proper place that was the studio that it was actually in a building that had a quite big commercial studio, the floor above. So we often, in fact, we always borrowed our microphones from them. So we always had really fantastically high quality microphones. But in my sort of studio, or our studio really, with my equipment, and we finished the album, the first album, in its entirety with my gear. So we never went into a big studio, you know, to sort of finish it. We did a bit of that with the second album.
Well, you know, I mean, the differences to me of those two albums sonically are pretty profound. I mean, Normal Family sounds like, you mentioned you're all big fans of dub. It sounds very dub, or probably what I ignorantly would refer to as like dance hall, like, you know, this like reggae kind of vibe. I don't have a whole lot of context for it, but I think you know what I'm talking about. Whereas Dum Dum Baby is like super like dark and grimy, you know, it's and maybe it's coming from, you're telling me, these circumstances that kind of led up to that. So I'm not trying to take you to a dark place again by thinking about it, but I'm telling you that to say that Dum Dum Baby's like an album that I think is incredible. Like I love it and listen to it all the time. And wow. I know that when you're talking about, you know, Dwight being into film and stuff like that, I think another big reference point for me, and I don't know if you've heard this before, is it reminds me of, which came a little bit later, but the Fight Club soundtrack. Like I was super into that when that came out. And I know you guys are kind of into like the cinema aspect of it. So I just think that the sounds on Dum Dum Baby just being so, like I said, like just dark, but still, because Christine has such a beautiful voice, it's still kind of like optimistic, like you're almost trying to escape the darkness through her or something. But then you have, is Dwight the other vocalist in the band?
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of have him sprinkled throughout. That's almost like, I don't know, it's like a very like devil on my shoulder, angel on my shoulder kind of vibe. And I think it's so incredible. And it's really like nothing I ever listened to before up to that point. And really, I don't think a whole lot has touched it since then. So I certainly am not trying to, like I said, make you reflect on negative periods in your life, but I do want to bring to you the positive aspect of it, that you've made this art that's really stood the test of time.
Certainly in my opinion, I don't know, we would all kind of register that it was for the reasons I spoke to you before, but also for other stuff. I think I was going through a breakup of my marriage at the time, and there was, you know, we'd lost our relationship with Simon that kind of brought us kind of through, really, and he was a really encouraging force. And then suddenly we were, there was lots of components that kind of made it dark, and I guess it's inevitable that that would come out in the music. I think shifting kind of, I know Dwight's sort of interest in sort of gangster rap at the time was like, certainly kind of had a kind of a role to play sonically on the samples. You know, there were less sort of like kind of dub samples, and there were more kind of dark sort of, for want of a better expression, it was kind of more of a kind of a gangster rap approach in terms of its sound, you know, hard. And I think maybe undoubtedly the pressure of coming up with another album, because I remember, and quite understandably, Dwight was really keen to move on and get another bunch of material together, because, you know, the first album had been with us for a long time. The germs of the tracks on the first album had been with us for some of those tracks, you know, we maybe started in 93 or something, you know. So we were keen to sort of move on, but Dwight especially. And inevitably that meant that we were moving faster, and we were kind of like, you know, knocking the stuff out in a more typical kind of, you know, studio situation kind of scenarios, rather than a kind of a sort of slower fermentation, which was typical of the way we got the first album together. I think that had, you know, and maybe we didn't kind of have that process of like just sitting on stuff and letting it brew, maybe doing different versions, and, you know, kind of maybe that wasn't sort of strong, so let's try to do some more, you know, or change direction a bit. I think we felt like pretty much under pressure to get something together fairly quickly, or at least sort of, you know, not spend 3 years doing it, which was essentially how long we spent doing the first album.
Well, it certainly doesn't feel rushed. I mean, it has a very fleshed out aspect to it. I mean, even Rookery is like a 10 minute long. I mean, if you combine the two parts, you know, this kind of like saga. So it's got plenty of landscape to it, and different, you know, it's a really good headphones album. You hear all these different things kind of while it's playing. Yeah. So I certainly don't get that vibe. Like I said earlier, and you kind of confirmed, it does seem like it's a response to maybe negative things that were happening in your lives, because it's so much, I mean, it's just dramatically less optimistic sounding, or less bright sounding, I guess is a better word, you know, 'cause A Normal Family, like I said, it's got a lot of, I mean, a lot of those really reggae vibes with the rhythms and things like that. Yeah. But even the dub bass that comes over to Dum Dum, it makes it sound even more sinister, because it's this deep bass with these dark minor chord synths that you're putting on. It's just, I think it's just so cool. And I'm sorry that you had to go through things to make me happy.
Yeah. I suppose it's just occurred to me, Ryan, that, you know, in many ways, it was more of a kind of Roadrunner type album, you know, than The Normal Family, you know, that kind of fitting to be under the Roadrunner moniker. But it's a long time ago, and you know, we're sort of solid friends, you know, even to this day. But we kind of, I suppose we went through our different life courses for a bit post that time. I wasn't so much completely in touch with Dwight and Christine, and I think, you know, they were no longer involved as a relationship. But it's interesting to hear you being so positive about the second album, which is, you know, so at odds with my kind of underlying feeling. But even having a fresh listen to it this morning, I was kind of thinking,
you still don't like it even after listening to it today?
I just think the first album has so many wonderful kind of associations, and generally was the sort of had the whole sort of core of the sort of Baby Fox ideal, you know. Just sounds to me like a different band almost.
Well, I agree with that. I do think it sounds, like I said, not to be redundant here, I just think they sound totally different from each other. There's certainly fundamentals that are there. And there's songs on Dum Dum Baby that sound like Zodiac could have been on.
Yeah, that's true. Thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Another interesting aspect for me is that I remember when I first heard Nearly Beautiful, I thought that I was like, wow, Christine really sounds like Madonna on this song. And I didn't even know at the time that she had, in fact, worked on the song Ray of Light. So that being said, you guys being on this bigger label, she's worked with this huge pop star, or in general, worked on pop music, kind of has this commercial voice. Was there ever a time where you guys thought that even just for one song, you would try to make like a hit, like, oh, we're going to make like a radio hit. We have all the tools to do it.
No, it doesn't really work like that. I mean, well, yeah, it does sometimes, but so often that's not the case. No, I think, it's funnily enough, there is actually some material much later when we, I guess the closest we got to perhaps considering getting the band, well, it wasn't a case of getting the band back together again. I know that Dwight actually went back and did a master's in art at St. Martin's, and he was doing this project where he wanted to make a one-off vinyl. And I think at the time he was getting really into the yeah kind of scene of France in the, you know, mid 60s, which I'm really, really into as well, but I probably wasn't at the time. But we did a couple of tracks that no one's ever heard. I don't think so, at least. They might have been just, I think we had, they might have been sitting on a website at some point, but they were kind of an ode to that era, and they were about as close to sort of pop music, even though it was of another time, that we've ever got to.
What does the name Dum Dum Baby mean?
It was Dwight's title. And so, as so often, we never actually sort of sat down and discussed the kind of the minutiae of the kind of context or the language or... But I think he was kind of, I always thought it was like he was talking about Dum Dum bullets, you know, another, I mean, just to sort of underline the darkness of the whole thing, you know, I just assumed it was like Dum Dum bullets. And it's kind of hard to sort of maybe for you to imagine that we would be working in the studio together and not really kind of like sort of communicating closely about all the different aspects. But we sort of had different little kind of workstations in the studio, in a way. Dwight had kind of a kind of workstation with a sampler and sort of an early DJ sampler and headphones, and quite often would be sort of working, especially on the second album, sort of independently, and then we'd sort of come together sort of every so often. And certainly I never got involved in the lyrics. And the kind of the sort of the general backbone to the, you know, the philosophy behind a song or whatever, you know.
What about the artwork of the album? Did you guys collaborate on that at all?
That was Dwight. We knew like Dwight was just brilliant at that sort of stuff. And the Mandela he kind of came up with on the first album was just, well, that's just, it was kind of like, Dwight, that's his department. He's visuals completely. Even though he had interest in that, that was his lead. And I think he was quite interested in sort of photocopier kind of art. So that was all done on the photocopier, that second album. And it comes out as like super dark. I mean, it's if you want to, you know, you couldn't really kind of fathom anything darker than what he managed on that one. So I mean, you know, of course, like everyone probably imagined, oh, this looks like some, you know, buried infant. I mean, this is like, how dark do you want to get? But I kind of felt that, I think personally speaking, this is not as a Baby Fox thing, but personally speaking, I thought I would like to be able to say, are you sure about that, Dwight? Do you want to kind of think again or blah, blah, blah? But it's really difficult in those situations where you're taking, you know, you might be taking an individual role within the band to sort of, you're pursuing your kind of, you know, excellence in that particular area. And he probably, Dwight certainly kind of had things to say about how I would produce, but he would kind of leave it up to me because he knew that that was my department. So, you know, that was kind of like the roles. That's how the role kind of thing happened for us.
That seems like a little bit of give and take, right? You can't have too much pushback on his artistic direction in exchange for the fact that you can kind of be free to do what you want musically.
And also, I think that it's just occurred to me that I think, you know, we were kind of keen to give Dwight as much freedom and expression. This was, bear in mind, we'd just come back from America, I mean, me and Christine, and he must have been feeling so shitty about everything. And I remember thinking, like, you know, this is his chance, really, just to sort of, we'll take his lead on the direction musically and also on everything about that, because we had a huge jolly, you know, 3 weeks on tour in America doing all our stuff. And I kind of felt like, well, you know, whatever he wants to do, like, let's give him that, you know, due. Let's give him the opportunity to do it how he sees fit.
Kind of making it up to him that he didn't get to participate in the tour.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you guys ever feel pressure internally or externally of kind of fleshing it out more as like a band for like a live setting or even for recording, just having like more live instruments? Or was that I think you tried at some point to do more of a band, right?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. Never the intention. You've got to remember, never the intention to do it live. It was always a studio. It was kind of like a sound collage project in the studio, and we were loving it. It was just like kind of painting with ideas and sound and pictures and everything, the whole. But because we suddenly got like loads of press really quickly, like, I mean, unprecedented for a band that had never done a gig. You know, we got loads of press really quickly and really good press, and it was amazing. And that's why suddenly, like, the pressure was on, like, okay, you got to tour this, guys, you know. And so it was a bit like, well, how the hell do we do it? Because it's just a whole bunch of samples, and it's kind of like a soundscape of collage. And, you know, like, I play the keyboards, but Dwight doesn't play anything, and we haven't got a guitarist in the band and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was kind of like, how do we do this? So we came up with a way of doing it, which was, you know, we took a very early hard disk recorder out on the road with us. Fostex had just made, it sounds crazy now because it wasn't that long ago, but it was, you know, I think if you were a huge band, there were ways of doing stuff with backing tracks on tape, obviously, but on hard disk, it was quite a new thing. Anyway, we had this 8 tracks of, so I basically flew the songs or versions of them onto hard disk that we could control live to a certain extent. And we could actually, there was a way of editing them, you know, like even mid-tour if it wasn't working quite so well or something. And then we hired a guitarist and hired a bass player and a drummer to play on top, with, you know, basically playing to the because we thought, well, it's got to sound like I'm talking about the first album here, it's got to sound like the album, but it's got to be, have the dynamics. I knew that from playing live with different acts, and even as a session player before, you know, it's got to work dynamically with kind of like, you've got to hear the splash of the cymbals. Otherwise, it's just really flat. But it was difficult, and it was quite a kind of difficult thing to make work live. You know, I don't think we ever nailed it. We DJ'd a few times, and that was a different experience. That was kind of much more fun because that was kind of like playing in the studio, much more like the original kind of thing. But obviously, yeah, we did the American thing, and that sometimes that worked well, and it depends. I seem to remember Austin was great. There were certain like little key memories that we had some fans. Like, how did that happen? You know, actual fans that came to the gigs, you know. But we never did. I don't think we toured the second album at all. Maybe did three or four gigs, and we did one big launch party. And that was kind of like a rave almost, which was fun because we had complete control over the sound and the sort of whole visuals and everything.
Well, really, you guys were just ahead of your time because, I mean, nowadays, that setup of just you kind of going and like, are you familiar with the band Churches?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's two guys and a girl. The two guys play the laptop computer and she sings. You guys would have been in. You could have just...
Yeah. You know, the idea of adding the bass guitar and drums, that was, you know, that might have been an error on my part. I thought we needed it. Maybe we were just like, in hindsight, we were creating a lot of work for ourselves. And, you know, laptops didn't exist. Well, they weren't powerful enough to do it. So we had to do, I guess we could have just had the confidence to do like a bunch of dub plates. That's what I would do nowadays. I would just do, you know, a dub plate for each track that was kind of different and do extended remix and just do some shit on top and kind of like really loosen it up and have some fun rather than, you know, more of a kind of almost a conservative approach with a band sort of thing. You know, that might have been in retrospect, it might be my mistake on that part.
Well, to be honest with you, I think that would be, I mean, really cool to see in here is these songs kind of produced with a live band. That's just my personal take. But as far as like you're saying, of course laptops didn't exist back then, but I'm saying like nowadays, you know, even DJs and you know, there's these giant EDM festivals and things like that may have existed to some scale in the 90s, but certainly it's a bigger scene now than it ever was. You would have been right in it. What I'm saying is now is the time to regroup. All right, let's get back on the road.
Yeah.
Well, being on Roadrunner, I mean, did you have at this time, there's bands that in my mind, maybe, or acts, I should say, that maybe you would have had some sort of connection to. Junkie XL is on Roadrunner at the time.
Yeah. I remember at the time thinking like, yeah, who is this guy? He's kind of like really clever. And he makes, I mean, that those hookups never happened. I think, you know, if we had done a third album, maybe they would have done. I think Junkie XL would have been a really good choice to actually produce the third album, and it would have been really easy to do, right? Because it'd been a cool. I went to see Sepultura in London because, like, it's like, oh, yeah, I've heard about this band, God, and oh, they're on Roadrunner. Shit, I mean, can we get some tickets? And went to see. They were, you know, that was really, really good. Completely not my kind of style of music, but as a kind of sound and as an idea, it was really, really good. And I guess because, okay, I mean, in practical terms, I think we were the only UK-based signing to Roadrunner.
Yes, you were. I don't want to take away from the fact that, of course, that Baby Fox was a unique act on Roadrunner. But I think sometimes bands, and especially at the time, felt like they were more on an island than they really were, because Roadrunner signed so many bands. I mean, they had so many bands on the roster, and the bands that maybe did really, really well that we think of when we think of the label, like Sepultura, like you mentioned, Typo Negative, Fear Factory. Yes, they were metal bands, but there was so many other bands that were nothing like that. Not to say there was anything like Baby Fox, but I mean, Junkie XL isn't like, you know, as big of a leap as And I mean, there's all these like Americana, like rock bands, there were rap rock bands, there was, I mean, just.
That was the problem because this guy Simon was like, I mean, you know, he must have felt, okay, thank you very much. You kind of bring me in. I've got my own label now. Suddenly I'm unceremoniously booted and that's the end of the deal. In fact, suddenly there was a real conflict of interest because he was actually our manager and continued to be our manager while we were on Malawi, because it kind of made sense. We'd just done it all together. Suddenly, like, he had zero power and he was kind of unceremoniously booted off his own sort of thing. We just thought, well, we can't have him as our manager because, you know, he can't go in there representing us. They've got zero respect for him, sort of thing. So, yeah, I think you touched on it there. We had no A&R kind of scenario. We had no one kind of really sort of seeing, putting all the pieces together, thinking like, well, no, you've got to, you know, even saying stuff like you were saying, hey, no, Dum Dum Baby's gone down really well here, blah, 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 blah. What we could do is this, blah, blah, blah. We had new management, but she actually renegotiated a deal for us, which was monetarily really good. But I think we'd sort of lost our way a bit and we didn't have good A&R at the label. That was the problem. I wonder if, we never met Say, so I wonder if we had, that might have had some different bearing on it, or if they'd replaced Malawi or actually think or kind of fronted it with a new kind of thing. But I think maybe the idea was like, well, that was a bit of an experiment. Yeah, we don't want to spend any more money on that. Kind of, let's just like let that one die, sort of thing, you know. So stuff like this is like, it's rare that everything kind of moves together all kind of nicely. And I think, you know, is you're well aware of how much effort it takes to get an album together. You know, after that album, we weren't going to kind of like, what happened then? Actually, no. you're reminding me of the kind of the timeline of what happened. And then we thought we've got to get off Roadrunner. we need to get a new deal so the band could continue. And our new manager couldn't. She just couldn't get any traction anywhere. So we sacked her. And then we got someone else that we kind of knew, and she was managing, she was very successful with two bands. Now, what were they called? Big English dance bands. And we had some new material by then. We had, which was probably more akin to the first album. I think we all really liked it, but I especially thought, okay, this is possibly a new kind of direction for us. And it was sort of, it wasn't any less lightweight, any more lightweight than Dum Dum Baby, but it had a kind of, maybe it had a bit more of a melodic kind of ring to it.
Well, what is something sonically? I know, of course, the creation of it had its turmoil, but sonically with Dum Dum Baby, what is something that you do like more than Normal Family? Seems like you really love Normal. We're like on opposite ends here. I really love one. You really love the other.
Yeah.
What is something that you like about Dum Dum Baby more than Normal Family?
God. Well, could I just maybe continue with one more element? I think sonically, that detracted from it. We started, in fact, not on all tracks, but I think most of the tracks on Dum Dum Baby, we used a real drummer and we were using our live drummer to play real drums on it. And I think that was an error, you know, because it was like, it just took away from the impressionistic sort of vibe of Collage that really kind of like summed up the Baby Fox. But something that I really liked about Dum Dum Baby, well, there was a tune, in fact, That's the Way It Is. When your world is spinning round, the minute your head is in clouds. That's a track that Christine and our sound guy had written years and years and years and years ago. And I always thought it was a bit of a gem. And I think we were probably looking for a track count and... you know, I think I suggested, well, why don't we do that? So it's a lovely old tune. Let's do a version of it. And I'd love—I don't think we nailed it, but I'm glad we got it on the album and it came to light rather than just floundering as a demo somewhere on cassette. It's you remind me actually of something that we really did enjoy. We massively enjoyed doing the press, because you know we like words and we like kind of you know the cultural context of our influences and also the photo sessions that invariably would come either you know on the same day or maybe another day or something. But you know we got to do some really cool, certainly for things like, you know, when we, do you remember that kind of sort of arty, fashion-y thing called Paper, a New York magazine called Paper? I remember doing a really good photo session for that and having lots of really interesting clothes to wear. And yeah, so I think a lot of bands don't like that part of it. But I think we always really enjoyed the interviews and the photo sessions.
I guess I should have asked you this at the beginning, but what does the name Baby Fox come from?
Okay, well, it stems from that afternoon session. We went to this op shop. Actually, I can remember it distinctly now. We went and had a couple of beers at this pub in Islington somewhere, Chapel Market, that's right. And there was this really old... you call them op shops in America, right?
Thrift store is what we would call
thrift
it.
Store, thank you. Op shop is something else, isn't it? Yeah, so it's like a thrift store that had been there. I reckon it had been there for decades and decades, and it was kind of like, it was utterly fascinating. And we were, and that was definitely Dwight's idea. Let's go and get some stuff to wear for the recording session tonight. You know, we were quite organized about that kind of, that day, that evening. It was a Saturday. And so... Christine found a fox stole, you know, when they kind of like it was sort of fashioned into a probably from the 30s or 40s, you know, or even older, I don't know, where, you know, they have an entire fox that had been sort of, it would have a backing and ladies would wear it around their neck, you know. And so it became almost a talisman sort of thing. Like she wore it. But our names stem from that. Like, so the name of the band was like, it was Baby. She was originally Baby B. I was Nurse G, because I was kind of like, I was operating the sounds, you know, I was on the operating table. And Dwight was Bushmaster, which is kind of a reference to the whole kind of reggae thing, you know. Baby Fox featuring... Baby B. So yeah, it was this fox thing, dead fox that Christine had around our neck for that evening. That was the origin.
Thanks so much to Alex for telling us about a band that I always loved but never knew a lot about, and now I feel like I know everything. And if you want to know more about Baby Fox, well, good luck. They're an elusive trio, and it took me like a year to even make this episode happen, but I'm so psyched that it did. And hopefully, if you're familiar with the band, you have that same gratitude. And if you're not, you're even more grateful, because now you get to know about this record, Dum Dum Baby, 1998 Road Runner Records. More albums and episodes coming constantly, so make sure you're keeping up with the show on Instagram at MeetMePod, that you're giving it 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever it'll allow you to give your stars. Give generously, would you? And also, hey, you want some bonus episodes? You want albums from the Trustkill catalog that were distributed from Roadrunner? Patreon.com/MeetMePod. But in the meantime, and in between time, my name is Ryan Rainbow. This is Meet Meep. And yes, that's the best that I can come up with. Bye.
we on?
Just push the more.
Is this the same song?
What's it like?
Misery. Let the people of Detroit know what you think about that beautiful song.
I think that song is the bizom.
Do you like the fact that the... Is that the same song?
That sounded a little different, right?
She wants you to push or tush. You understand? Listen.
Against your wall.
Enough already! What the hell is this?
Hey, yo, you hired this guy?
They got music like that in the Bronx?
No, not at all.
Meep, meep.